Finally, we were back at the house and wrapping things up. We had said everything we had wanted to. We had countered every trick and bullying technique he had tried to pull with solidarity and strength. I had thought he was actually going to hit me once, when I'd said that if he thought that his abusive behaviour was not connected to unhappiness or events in his own life, then he was basically admitting that he was psychotic. It was a big word, I knew, but seriously. Again, his stick had banged against his boots several times, and eventually he turned his gaze towards me and stared deep into my eyes. I knew what he wanted to do. I had seen that look many, many times before, but what would happen now if he tried it? I would most certainly retaliate. Tom would come to my aid. During this stare-off, I visualised my father on the ground, restrained and spitting like the angry, bewildered animal he was. But he backed down. "I am not a psychopath," he seethed and marched ahead once more. "Thank you," I said, and I truly meant it. "Thank you for letting us come here today and get this off our chests. I hope you understand how much we needed to do this. And I hope you understand that we want to move on and put this behind us. And if you want to have a relationship with us, we're willing to have one with you. But you need to make an effort. You have to reach out. You need to show us that you care about continuing. We're not coming to see you out of duty anymore. This has to be a two-way thing. So the ball's in your court." We got back in the car, and as soon as we were out of sight of the house, we both burst into screams of joy and relief. I couldn't believe we'd done it. Not just done it, we had triumphed. We had spoken honestly and without malice. We had stood up to him. We had truly given back to him that which was not ours and which we should never have had to deal with in the first place. "You did great, Alan," Tom smiled at me, "and you hardly looked at the script at all." As we were getting into the car, our father had started to back away from us and turned quickly towards the house. As he did so, I could see there were tears in his eyes. I could tell we had truly connected with him. Maybe there was hope that he would step up to the plate after all. I never heard from him again. Friday the 4th of June, 2010. It's amazing how quickly your life can return to normal. Well, that is if your normal is getting up at 5 a.m. and spending a couple of hours transforming yourself into a lady and then pretending said lovely lady is in various states of distress, mourning, or sexual compromise. With each day that passed, I filled my head a little more with my work and my co-workers, and every day brought a new scene, new actors, often a new decade, and of course, new costumes. Desiree was not a twin set and pearls kind of gal. Even off duty from the club, and doing a spot of light shopping with her adopted daughter, she dressed the nines. The runaway, Kathy, was played by Joanna van der Ham, a fellow Scot I nicknamed Perth because of her birthplace, and with whom I spent many a morning chortling away at the latest ensemble I had donned. Cape Town was also in a state of frenzy about the looming World Cup soccer tournament. The whole city felt like it was in one of those home improvement TV shows where someone is tricked into going away for a couple of days, and in their absence, loads of people descend on their house and garden and remodel them in a flash. Every morning on the way to work, I would see new trees along the side of the road that had been planted in the night. Sidewalks being repaved, the entire population united in giving their city a sparkly makeover to counter the glare of the world's attention. It was an exciting time to be there, to be sure, but also an anxious one. Just like on those TV shows, I worried that they wouldn't be finished in time, and all the work would be for naught. But of course, just like on those TV shows, they pulled it out of the bag, and the world descended and was in awe at this gleaming metropolis, little knowing that the paint was barely dry. Then, of course, the tournament started, and the makeover frenzy turned to the competition. The South Africans called their team Bafana Bafana, which means boys, boys. I loved that. Imagine how much more affectionate it would feel if Scotland, sadly a non-qualifier for this World Cup, called its national team Lads, Lads, or Fellas, Fellas. Sometimes, when we were working during a match, our filming would have to be halted due to the sheer volume of the locals cheering when Bafana Bafana scored. Sometimes we had to stop because the cheering came from some of our crew. And then, of course, there were the vuvuzelas, plastic horns that became a constant soundscape during my time in Cape Town. At first, I found them fun and spirited. I myself am no stranger to a good loud whistle or kazoo at certain times of celebration. But the sheer volume and the sheer volume of the vuvuzelas made them soon lose their original appeal and eventually become almost maddening. If you saw some of the games on television and despaired at their constant cacophony, just imagine living in a city where that sound was a constant 24/7. After a while, I perfected a way to zone them out, but I was only able to do so when they were played en masse. A lone vuvuzela being blown in the car park beneath my apartment in the middle of the night was enough to send me spiralling into nail-scratching irritation. It was a heady time to be in South Africa, though. So much so that when I returned to my trailer on the Friday of my first week back to find an email from my office with the subject, DNA test results, I was jolted back into a world I'd almost forgotten existed. I was ashamed at how quickly I'd moved on. Then. Once, a long time ago, when I was a very little boy and before the trouble started, my father went into the hospital for an operation. I know it was a long time ago and before it all went bad, because I remember that on the day he was to return home, I ran as fast as my little legs could carry me when the school bus dropped me off at the gates in order to get home and see him. I'd missed him, you see. When I got there, breathless, he was nowhere to be seen. I looked in the living room, the kitchen, his office, even the good room that nobody ever went into except at Christmas. Where could he be? I went upstairs to my parents' bedroom to see if he was there, but no. Finally, I wondered if he hadn't been released from hospital after all, but made one last-ditch attempt and opened the door to the spare bedroom downstairs. That's another reason why I know it was a long time ago before it all went bad. That bedroom became my mum's shortly afterwards, but then it was still the spare. I opened the door quickly and rushed in, not expecting to see anything, let alone the horror I encountered. My father was asleep on his back, his face a mess of bruises and bloody bandages. He looked like Frankenstein's monster. I was terrified. He didn't stir, thankfully, and I immediately turned on my heels and left the room, pulled the door carefully shut, and walked away through to the kitchen to set the table and do my chores. I decided it hadn't happened. I hadn't seen him. When my mum came home, she asked me if I'd seen my father, and I lied and said no. We went through together to the spare room and woke him up. He still scared me, but the shock of seeing him had been diminished. I pretended to be more shocked than I actually was. I acted, maybe properly for the first time. My parents comforted me. For the first time in my childhood, but certainly not the last, I encountered an upsetting experience and decided the best way to deal with it was to pretend it had never happened. And so it didn't. Here's what did happen. My father's broken nose was straightened and his breathing and sinus problems were over, and during his recovery period he was tended to by a nurse whom he began an affair with. And all our lives were changed forever. Friday the 4th of June 2010. My hand was trembling as I clicked open the email. There was an attachment with the actual medical report, and for a few moments I couldn't see anything but a blur of letters and numbers. Eventually, I saw that on the left there was a list of the various components of the overall test, and then two columns on the right that showed my results and Tom's. At the end of every single line, the numbers were the same. I looked down the list, the same series of figures, every one. I was gasping. Perhaps the fact that I'd so willingly immersed myself in my imaginary life here in South Africa made the shock even more pronounced. I kept staring at the lists and columns in front of me, and eventually they began to vibrate and go out of focus. I sat up and walked in a circle and immediately sat down again. I emailed my assistant. Brian, I'm in a state. I want to be really sure. Just confirm to me that this means Tom and I have the same father. Thanks. Alan. I got up and began changing out of Desiree's costume. There was a knock on the door and a wardrobe assistant came in to collect my clothes. I handed them to her in a daze and wished her a good night. Then I heard the familiar ping of an incoming email on my computer. I leapt back into the chair and opened it. Yes, your DNA and Tom's DNA absolutely match. He is your father. I'm so sorry. Immediately, rage overwhelmed me. I opened my mouth and let out a roar so deep and primal and furious that I scared myself. My knees buckled and I flopped down into the chair again. Then, I'd rushed home from work every night for weeks, hoping that the letter would have come, but each night I was disappointed. I had a job now, and so my father had less sway over me. I didn't have to work on the estate anymore, except during times when extra hands were really needed, like the previous Christmas when I'd worked weekends and evenings selling trees. People would ring our bell, and I'd walk them to the tractor shed where, on pulling open the doors, a blast of intense pine from the hundreds of felled spruce trees piled high against the walls assaulted your nose. I used to hate Christmas, because it would mean working late into the dark, freezing night, cutting trees, carting them to the sawmill yard, pushing their prickly, sappy carcasses through a tube to encase them in nylon netting, and carrying them to the buyer's cars or piling them high onto carts to be transported to shops in local towns. I also had to fake civility with my father in these cases. He was careful to appear strict but fair whenever we were in groups of people like this, careful to vent his habitual ire in the safety of the house or in the dark corner of a shed. Now, though, he had to ask me for my help, not order me. I was 17. I was a man. I was working as a sub-editor in a publishing house in Dundee, and I paid for my own keep. Each morning, I cycled past my father up the sawmill yard, still mindful of his disapproving eye. In my rucksack, I would have my preferred clothes, tight red jeans, black suede tucker boots, and a jacket with pins on my favourite band's logos on the lapels. And after I'd left the estate premises, his fiefdom, I'd change into them behind a tree and make my way down the hill to the village of Barry, feeling liberated and edgy, where I'd be picked up by a co-worker and driven to the big city of Dundee. I'd auditioned for drama school late in the spring. Mum had gone to Glasgow with me and was waiting on the steps as I came running out to tell her I'd been called back for the second round of improvisation later that afternoon. We went for lunch, but I could barely eat, I was so excited. Then, at the end of the day, we got the train back home, and I daydreamed about the life that seemed tantalisingly within my grasp. I had no idea you could actually go to college and study to be an actor. I hadn't even really entertained the possibility that it could ever be anything other than a hobby for me. Then I heard that a girl a couple of years above me at high school had gone to somewhere called the Academy. It sounded so impossibly grand and out of my realm, but the more I researched, the more I knew it was where I wanted to go, where I needed to go. It was my salvation. My parents were initially very wary of the idea, but the fact that I'd get a degree at the end of it reassured them. The phrase, something to fall back on, was oft repeated around that time. I wasn't sure what it was I would be falling back from or on, but I didn't care. I just wanted out. "There's a letter for you," my mum said, thrusting the envelope into my hand as I came in the door, still sweaty from the bike ride up the March's Hill. The postmark was Glasgow. It was typed, not handwritten. I flipped it over, the return address confirming that this was indeed the letter I'd been waiting for. "I'll leave you to open it on your own." And she was gone into the kitchen. My hands trembled. The next few seconds would either change my life or... what? I hadn't auditioned for or applied to any other schools. I was still too young to be considered for university. I would have to wait another whole year before I'd have a chance like this again. "I got in!" I yelled in joy, and immediately the kitchen door flew open and Mum rushed in to hug me. "I start in September," I said in disbelief. I was going to be free. "I'm so proud of you, son." She turned away from me, sobs gurgling up from somewhere deep. I went upstairs to the big room and sat staring out at the fields and fields of green. I was numb. It was actually going to happen. When I went down again to eat, my father was home. Mum had obviously told him my news. "All right, that's the response you were looking for, was it?" he said, as he passed me on the way to the kitchen. "Yes," I replied to his back. Friday the 4th of June 2010, seconds later. I remember that Tom was copied on the email too, and I picked up my phone to call him, but I knew that I couldn't have that conversation here. I needed to be alone and at home, so I tried to calm myself down enough to be able to walk to Hodge's car and get back to my apartment. I picked up my bags and opened the trailer door. I said friendly goodbyes to crew members I passed, signed my name on the union timesheet, took my call sheet for the next day's filming, and then I was off. You know how sometimes you don't intend to do something and then you do, and it turns out to be the best thing you ever could have done? I told Hodges. I have to phone my father tonight and tell him that I am actually his son, Hodges, I blurted. The old man's eyes widened, but he kept his eyes on the road. I think you need to start at the beginning, Alan, he said calmly. I told him everything. He already knew all about Who Do You Think You Are and Tommy Darling, as he had shared my excitement in the lead-up to the start of filming and was anxious to hear the revelations on my return. But I hadn't told him about my father. He listened in silence as I unravelled before him. It seemed even more surreal and ridiculous when I heard it spoken out loud. We had arrived at the apartment building and I was still going, so Hodges turned off the ignition and waited patiently for me to finish. So now I'm going upstairs, I'm going to speak to my brother, and then I'm going to call my father and tell him, I said finally. You must not do that, Alan, he said quietly but firmly. I was startled into silence. I looked across at his unblinking eyes trained on me. He was sad for me, which was clear, but he looked serious too. He meant what he had said. You are angry. You have a right to be angry, and you should be angry, but you must not call your father in anger. Speak to your brother. Get it out of your system with him, and then sleep. Call your father tomorrow, when anger will not cloud what you need to say to him. I opened my mouth to speak, but nothing came out. He was right, of course. Thank you, Hodges, I managed eventually. You are welcome, Alan. Sleep well. Wisdom and guidance can come from the most unexpected places. Tom had the same reaction as me, rage. We spoke for a long time, going round and round in circles, trying to make sense of it all. Why had he done this? Was it the last hurrah of a heartless dying man? Did he really set out to confuse and upset us one last time? Surely not. Surely not even he was capable of such cruelty. But if not that, then why? Had he truly believed this? Had he harboured this suspicion all my life, and only now, when he thought it might come out publicly, had he felt forced to reveal it? That didn't make sense either. We talked about our early childhood, before his affairs and our beatings had become so regular and prevalent. If he had believed this from my birth, why would he have waited so many years to enact his warped revenge? Was he seriously waiting for me to grow old enough that he could start beating me? What about the way he treated Tom? He was his undoubted heir, and he beat him just the same. The only sense we could make of it was that yet again we were his victims. After all these years, he was still able to surprise us with the depths of his, what, cruelty? Cowardice? Check. Madness? I'd always thought my father was an angry, violent man, frustrated and trapped like an animal in a cage, lashing out at those weaker than himself to blame them for and validate his situation. But now I was beginning to think there might be more to it than mere venom. I started to consider the possibility that my father was simply mentally ill. But I realised I couldn't go down that particular rabbit hole right now. There was something more pressing and more important to think about. Mum. We would have to tell her this story, and I knew it would devastate her. Not just by the enormity of the lie that my father believed to be true, but by the longevity of its effects on us all. I said goodnight to Tom. We were both exhausted, but the chat had done us good. It was exactly 2 weeks since that night in London when Tom had come round and we'd gone onto the roof deck. 2 weeks in which I had clung eagerly to the belief that I was not my father's son. Now all that was dashed. Now I had to readjust to the fact, the absolute medical fact, that I was. Of course, it was good to know the truth, but it was hard to let go of the fantasy I'd carried and nurtured for the past 14 days. You know, I was so happy not to be his son, I said, as Tom and I were hanging up. But at least now I know I'm your full brother. Saturday the 5th of June, 2010. As soon as the first assistant director called lunch, my stomach clenched. I went back to my trailer and ate the food that was waiting for me. I had never chewed my food so well. I reached for my phone and dialed his number.
Hello?
He said. The signal was scratchy and weak. It's Alan, I began.
Oh, yes.
I'm calling to tell you I got the results of the DNA test, and I want you to know that I am your son. Almost immediately, he replied,
Well, I'm very glad to hear that.
Then the line went dead. I leapt back in my seat. What? What had he just said? He was glad? And did he hang up on me? He couldn't have. It must be the connection. I rang again. The line was slightly better this time.
Yes?
I don't think you heard me properly, I began again. I got the results, and I am your son. I'd never enunciated so clearly. There was silence at the other end of the line. I wondered if I'd lost him again.
Well, I'm very surprised to hear that,
he said, sounding genuinely shocked. I bet you are, I replied. I waited for him to make the next move. I could feel his mind whirring, trying to make sense of it all. The tables had turned for once.
Are you absolutely sure?
He asked. Totally. I can send you a copy of the results if you like. Tom and I have identical Y chromosomes. Believe me, if I wasn't your son, I would not lie to you about it. I checked myself. I was getting mean. My anger was seeping through. I needed to not alienate him. This was my last ever chance to try and understand him and why he had done this, and I mustn't blow it. It never happened, Dad. You imagined it all. Mum never had an affair. None of it ever happened. But I had to believe it, Alan, he said incredulously and incredibly. This really intrigued me. You had to, I replied. Why? I saw them coming out of the room. Whatever you saw was innocent. You made it all up. I felt like I was talking to a child or someone coming round from an anaesthetic and needing to have everything reiterated again and again.
I saw what I saw, he said,
over and over. No, I countered. You saw what you wanted to see or what you decided you'd seen. There was silence. I could feel him regrouping and preparing for his next salvo. But you must have known, he began. I tried to imagine how much of a shock this must be for him, but I was the one who was shocked about his inability to accept the truth, let alone to consider what I and Tom had been through these last 2 weeks. It was utterly illuminating and predictable at the same time. How could I have known, Dad? It never happened. You imagined it. It was a figment of your imagination. I am your son. I wondered if I should just hang up. He was obviously not capable of dealing with this information or reality in any form. Perhaps I should give him some time to process everything. I could call back in a day or two, but then I thought, what would be the point of that? I had more important things to contend with, like talking to Mum and taking care of myself. That was when he blindsided me. I didn't do this to hurt you, Alan. I inhaled in the way you do when you're about to cry. It felt like an apology, although technically it wasn't. But it was enough to stop me in my tracks, to marvel at how it felt to hear my father show some feeling, some tenderness. But was that truly what he was doing? His first line of defense had failed. Perhaps now he was trying to emotionally manipulate me. I realized how tired I was of trying to second-guess him. I've been doing it for over 40 years. Look, I believe that you believed this. I don't think that you just made it up. But you have hurt me. You have hurt me all my life. And you've hurt Tom and you've hurt Mum, I said calmly.
But you know we never bonded, was my father's response.
That was it. Maybe we never bonded because you were treating me like shit because you thought I was another man's child, I said. I could feel him reel.
There's no need for that, he said, anger in his voice.
There's every need for it. You have lived your life based on a false assumption, and the fact that you're trying to use that to justify the way you abused me is really despicable. And in that instant, I saw the double blow of his justifying that abuse in any way at all, let alone based on a figment of his imagination.
I had to believe it, he offered again, scared now and repeating himself.
No, you didn't, because you made it up. There was nothing to believe. I almost felt sorry for him, but I wanted to say one last thing, one thing that needed to be said, one thing that I never thought I'd have the strength to say. It never happened. And I can't believe you never talked to Mum about it, and you had to wait for me. My voice squeaked a little. I was starting to lose it, but I knew this was nearly over, and I had to get it out. I had to be the one to tell you the truth. For 45 years, you never had the balls to find out the truth for yourself. You just acted upon a suspicion. You based your entire life upon a false assumption, and you made all our lives hell. I waited for a response. Surely he could give me something.
just some acknowledgement that he understood the enormity of the pain he had caused, at least in the last 2 weeks, if not for a lifetime. I should have known better. "I decided I won't be talking to that Sunday Mail fellow," he said, as though what I'd said had never happened. He sounded almost breezy. I could tell he thought he was throwing me a bone, giving me something positive. He reminded me of addicts I've known, lighting fires around themselves as a smokescreen to mask the real issue. "You know, I really don't care if you speak to them or not," I said, and I truly meant it. "I'm going to go now. I imagine you have a lot of processing to do, considering you now have to reassess the past 45 years. Silence. "Okay, take care. I'll talk to you soon." I stopped. What was I saying? If ever there was a time for the truth, it was now. "Actually, I won't be speaking to you again. But take care."
"Aye,"
was the last thing my father ever said to me. "Bye," I said, and hung up. I looked up at myself in the mirror of my trailer. I just had the most horrible conversation of my life, and the very last conversation I would ever have with my tormentor. I was free of him at last. I wonder what he would have done had he known that during that conversation I was wearing high heels, a bra and panties, and a full face of makeup. Now, of course, I had to tell Mary Darling. I knew that eventually I would have to talk to her one way or the other, but this outcome was always going to be the hardest. Had it gone the other way and I was not my father's son, I would have gone to her with elation. Curiosity too, of course, about the reason she had kept it a secret for so long, but elation, both for her and for me. Now I went to her with dread. I knew the only outcome would be upset and anger and sadness. Again. I even considered not telling her at all. We had spoken several times over the past 2 weeks, in reference to her father's unfolding story, about the importance of being open and not having secrets in a family, and how good ultimately is to know the truth, so how could I consider staying silent? Over the years, my father had become estranged not just from his wife, his sons and his grandchildren, but also most of his other immediate family. If ever there was an example of the dangers of failing to communicate, Alec Cumming was it. I wrote the whole story down. I knew I couldn't tell her the whole thing over the phone. There was just too much to it and it was still very raw for me. I also knew that on the telephone I wouldn't be able to hold it together and my mum would become upset hearing me so devastated. Plus, writing it down made it more real somehow. This wasn't all a nightmare that I woke from screaming. It had, in fact, happened. I got it all down in a long and emotional email. Then I called Mary Darling to tell her the message was coming. She wasn't in, and I left her a voicemail. "Mom, it's Alan. Look, I don't know any other way to do this. I'm about to send you an email that you'll find shocking and upsetting. It's about Dad. Tom and I are fine. We're both fine. Don't worry about us. But we've had some interactions with Dad, and it's been awful. And I wrote you an email so you would have all the information. And once you've read it and you're ready to talk, please call me. I love you, Mum, okay? I have to go now. Take care." There was a huge stone of hurt and sadness in my belly. The visit of an old acquaintance who needed to leave. I hoped this story I'd typed out, with tears in my eyes, would close the door once and for all. I scanned the text all the way down to the last paragraph. "It's amazing how Dad can still, even as he comes to the end of his life, cause such drama and pain to us all. Tom and I are here for you, Mum, and love you, and never stopped loving you throughout any of it. Alan." The next day we spoke. She'd had an awful night, sleepless and anguished. The first thing she said when she picked up the phone has stayed with me and always will. "I never knew he had so much evil in him, Alan." Part 2. Cancel, continue. I had 2 more weeks filming in Cape Town before I could return to New York, to Grant, and to getting on with my life. Luckily, I was busy working every day, and the little spare time I did have was filled with seeing friends who were in town or dinners with the producers and the cast of the miniseries. I told a couple of people the story. It just came out over a drink, but it was too soon and too weird and too inappropriate to really unleash it all.
When I got home to New York, I knew I'd have to start the process of normalizing this chapter of my life, making it something that had happened to me, not something I was still living. I had that empty, nagging ache inside, like someone had died or I'd been attacked. And of course, both things were true. My father was dead to me now, but he'd certainly left his marks on me before I'd shut the door on him. Technically, I suppose, he'd shut the door on Tom and me 16 years ago, that cold November afternoon when he walked back into our childhood home with tears in his eyes. That would probably have been the last time I'd ever have spoken to him had this not happened. I decided I was actually thankful for the opportunity to have proper closure. Bizarrely, after all these years and all that had happened, it felt like an amicable split. No hard feelings, just gobsmacked amazement. I wished him well. I truly did. And, for perhaps the first time in my life, I felt sorry for him. Over the next few weeks, I spoke to Tom and Mum often. We checked in with each other, gauging where the other was in the grieving process, for that is truly what it was. My mum had dreamt of the outcome of my appearance on Who Do You Think You Are, as giving her the answers about her father she had always longed for. Instead, my father had intervened and ruined her chance for pure happiness. Mary Darling had no idea that her husband had harboured such beliefs about her for all those years. In the many talks with her that followed, I began to formulate my initial theories about why, and more importantly, when, he had begun to believe that I was not his son. Mum remembered the night in question, all those years ago in Dunkeld at the dance in the hotel, but her version of events was quite different. She had not gone to another room. They had not been discovered. She told me that the man in question, my supposed father, had a bit of a drink problem and she remembered him needing to talk about it that night. So not only was my father gravely mistaken in his impression of what had gone on between them, he had also seen an act of kindness and consideration on my mother's part as betrayal and deceit. Of course, that made perfect sense. I remembered how easily my dad could see the negative in any exchange. More and more, as we dug further into the past, I began to remember how deeply and often my father twisted reality into the paranoia-filled world he inhabited. I relived many occasions in my childhood when his anger erupted illogically. He would suddenly take against someone or something for reasons that were often impossible to fathom, certainly to a little boy, and because usually he would not voice them. As soon as his mind was made up, there could be no mention of the person or thing without risking his rage. Whether we liked it or not, we too had to make that person or thing disappear. But in the case of my conception, there had been no outbursts or fury. My father's version of the event at the hotel, with him grabbing my mum and saying, "Well, there's no point in staying here any longer," did not ring any bells with her at all. It was as shocking for her to hear as it had been for me. I asked Mum if she could remember anything at all in his behaviour while she was pregnant with me that hinted at his suspicion. She couldn't. Indeed, she told me a very touching story about my father rushing down the hill to get her fish and chips from the village to quell her pregnancy cravings, and also how happy he had been when I was brought home from the hospital. But with that story of his rare thoughtfulness came another bit of truth. "A man like your father, Alan, a proud man but an angry man, would never have let me through the door if he thought I was carrying another man's child." She was right, of course. Although it had been easy to believe the issue was never discussed between them in the years that followed, like so many dark secrets in our house, it made no sense whatsoever that my father would not have confronted her when she learned she was pregnant with me. His pride would never have allowed him to stay silent. So it became clear that at some point later, who knew when, he had decided it was the truth. I absolutely believe that my father had not made up this tale as an attempt to hurt me or derail my life, although he had succeeded at both. It was too multi-layered and complex a deceit for that to ring true. Also, and this was both a revelation and an arrow to my heart, I knew he didn't care enough about me to go to such elaborate lengths. It became clear that this myth had been hatched to benefit only one person, himself. Somewhere along the line, my father had decided this was true to make himself feel better about the way he was treating my mother and the way he was abusing me. Of course, the awful, glaring flaw in this logic is that he had also been a monster to Tom, too. It didn't make sense. But of course, it shouldn't, and it couldn't. I was trying to fathom my father's psychopathic behaviour that was based on a huge delusion. Surely it was not a big leap to think he might have found his own logic to merit Tom's abuse, too.
But every night, just as sleep began to smooth out the rattling of my brain, I would return to the same thought. I couldn't believe I was related to him. Maybe I'd wanted it to be true so much. Maybe that wish had actually seeped into my psyche, but now I couldn't accept that I was his son. And although I was, I most certainly was, I had the documents to prove it, I knew with every fibre of my being that there was nothing aside from blood that related him to me. And that's what kept me going. I may have been a robotic transvestite acting machine by day, and a preoccupied and cheerless dinner companion by night, but there was a light at the end of my tunnel. I was not my father's son. Sunday the 20th of June, 2010. I returned to New York and immediately dove into work. I was to perform in concert for a week at Feinstein's, Michael Feinstein's eponymous cabaret space at the Regency Hotel on the Upper East Side. I'd played for a week there earlier in the spring to a great reception. I knew my song choices were probably a little idiosyncratic and certainly politically challenging for the club's regular demographic. But I believe if you're honest, true to yourself and committed, and especially if you use humour as a tool as well as a balm, people will respect you perhaps more than if they agreed with everything you said. It's actually quite a good ethos for life. Go into the unknown with truth, commitment and openness, and mostly you'll be okay. I'd started singing in concert like this only the year before. For years, I'd wanted to do a show of my own. On the rare occasions when I sang a song at a gala or benefit, not in character, but as Alan Cumming, I was amazed at how different that felt. I wanted to pursue that feeling in more depth one day. But singing as myself brought with it many terrors. As I mentioned, I had no character to hide behind. I was singing as me. That felt like an enormous and terrifying leap to make, and that is why, until not too long before, I rarely made it. I also had an added issue about singing in general. I can sing. I've sung often through the years in various plays and films, and many years ago I actually released an album with my friend Forbes Masson as our comedy alter egos Victor and Barry. But I'm not one of those singers. You know, the Broadway belters, the beautiful singers. And even worse, since I've been on Broadway and even won a Tony Award for Best Actor in a Musical, I felt that more and more people expected me to be one of those singers. They expected me to have that sort of polished sound, and I just don't. I don't want to, mind you. But one of the troubles with becoming more and more well-known, and in this case, well-known for something you don't feel very confident about, is that you feel there is more and more of a chance you will disappoint. I think also I was hampered by the perceived notion that actors like nothing better than to stand up in a crowded room and make a speech or sing a song. Both these activities, but especially the latter, would send me into paroxysms of panic, and even with major rehearsal could induce severe, almost insurmountable nerves. So you can understand why it was an experience I wasn't in a hurry to repeat. I'm not normally like that about acting. I'm usually quite relaxed about that, except for on opening nights. And of course, the more you do something, the more comfortable you become and the less frightening it becomes. I realised that the only way to both conquer my fear and embrace my desire about singing was to accept a proposal my manager put to me to perform a concert in Lincoln Center's American Songbook series in February 2009. And I was right. The more I did it, the more relaxed I became and the better I got. The more relaxed and the better I got, the more I did it. Nowadays, I hop on stage regularly to sing a song or duet with someone. And though I still get nervous, it's the good kind of nerves, the necessary kind, that keeps you on your toes and makes sure the adrenaline is flowing. That first night, though, at the Allen Room of Jazz at Lincoln Center, a beautiful hall with enormous glass windows overlooking Columbus Circle and Central Park, I was very far from relaxed. My manager came to my dressing room to see how I was before the first show, and I told her I wanted to punch her. 90 minutes later, I was euphoric. I'd done it. I'd felt the fear and done it anyway, and I'd enjoyed it, and so had the audience, and best of all, I'd felt that connection. The rawest, purest connection you can only feel when you let the audience see inside you. I was hooked. Next stop was the Sydney Opera House, as part of the Mardi Gras Festival, followed by runs at the Vaudeville Theatre in London's West End and the Geffen Playhouse in Los Angeles. Yes, I have always believed in starting small. And now, here I was, back at Feinstein's, singing a song I'd written about my disdain for plastic surgery to a room filled with people, many of whom had obviously had plastic surgery.
telling stories about what I thought was the essential American experience, being on an M&M's float in the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, then singing a searing, biting diatribe against all that is American, written by my musical director, Lance Horn, then asking the audience to contribute to a campaign to eject state politicians who had voted against marriage equality, before finishing with a rousing ditty with the chorus, "You're fucking beautiful, and when I kiss your lips I hear those fucking angels sing." You get the gist. It defined eclectic, and it was exactly what I needed. Each night I walked out onto the tiny stage, and for 90 minutes my mind and my body were completely disengaged from what I'd just been through. The days were spent quietly, resting and walking our dogs in Central Park. Grant and I had decided to stay in a suite in the hotel that housed Feinstein's, as in a week I'd be off again to complete my turn on Who Do You Think You Are, and going up and downtown each day in the New York heat seemed unnecessarily exhausting. So every night, after the show, I could just pop back through the kitchens, up the service elevator, and head back to my suite, and my husband, and true comfort. Each night, Grant and I would have drinks there, with the friends who'd come to the show, and each night I would recount the stories of Tommy Darling and Alec Cumming, the two men who so completely filled my waking hours. It felt good to talk. Everyone was amazed by what I had to say. Their questions were thought-provoking and sometimes allowed me new insight into what I'd discovered. But mostly, I felt solidarity and support and love. Ironically, three things I never felt from my father, and three things I think Tommy Darling could have done with a whole lot more of. Sunday the 27th of June, 2010. When I arrived at Newark Airport on Sunday morning, I was told my flight to Beijing had been delayed and I would miss my connection to Kuala Lumpur. I was supposed to have arrived there on Monday afternoon and had an evening and a good night's sleep to acclimatise myself and prepare for filming beginning on Tuesday. Now, alas, I would not arrive till Tuesday morning and would have to immediately start filming as soon as I landed. Never an ideal situation, but certainly not when you're going to be on camera, sans grooming, after travelling for a day and a half. I managed to call Elizabeth, the director, and she eased my qualms by saying that the first day of filming was pretty light anyway, and all I'd be doing was examining a few documents in the hotel. There was nothing left to do but enjoy the luxury of the Air China lounge. As a self-confessed airline lounge whore, I had no problem with that at all. In this bubble, this fancy no man's land, I found myself decompressing after a week of cabaret and confession. I brought my mind back round to my grandfather and the outcome of his story, which I knew was going to be explosive. As much as I was eager to solve the mystery of how he died, I was also wary of what I might learn. Tuesday the 29th of June, 2010. I began filming in a hotel room overlooking the myriad beauties of Kuala Lumpur, which were, this morning, being drenched by a huge thunderstorm. From our skytop vantage point, we could see the dark clouds careening towards us and the lightning reflecting across the dozens of glass towers we looked down upon. Elizabeth's assurance that the first bit of filming would be light buoyed me as I struggled with jet lag and the crew set up. On a table in front of me were some official-looking documents, face down until the cameras would roll. It was nice to see everyone again. I'd only known these people for 1 week before our month-long hiatus, but it was quite a week in terms of what we'd all gone through together, and being back amongst them felt comforting. And suddenly, the next week and the inevitable bombshell of Tommy Darling's demise felt less daunting. That feeling was not to last long. As the cameras began to roll, I turned over the first document. It was Tommy Darling's death certificate. It had come from the Malaysian National Archive. It read, "Original Certificate of Death, Police Lieutenant T. Darling, Cause of Death, GS, Wound in Head." GS, gunshot, wound in head. I went on to the autopsy report. On 22nd June 1951 at 8 a.m, I performed an autopsy on the body of an adult male European identified by PC 10112 as T. Darling, Police Lieutenant, aged 35 years. There was one gunshot wound of entry about 3 inches behind and level with the right ear. There was no charring of the skin. The occipital lobes of the brain were grossly lacerated, and a very misshapen bullet was recovered from the left occipital lobe of the brain. Cause of death, shock and hemorrhage from gunshot wound of head. I was so unprepared for this. If today was light, what was the rest of the week going to be like?
One gunshot wound of entry about 3 inches behind and level with the right ear. This was all wrong. I've been told he died in an accident while cleaning his gun, but you don't clean your gun by pointing it to the side of your head. And then another thought struck me. You don't kill yourself like that either. Had my grandfather been murdered? What was going on here? As if on some supernatural cue, a huge, deafening clap of thunder exploded across the sky. I leapt out of my seat. The fact that there had been no charring of my grandfather's skin could only mean that he was shot at extremely close range, and the fact that the bullet entered the back of his head suggested he was executed in some paramilitary manner. Suddenly, finding the truth about Tommy Darling's end seemed menacing and not at all liberating as I'd hoped. I'd been given some information about Chaha, the village where Tommy had been stationed. Because of its position on the main route through the country of Malaya, it had become a hotspot for terrorist activity and was policed 24 hours a day by my grandfather's security force. I feared that Tommy Darling had met a vicious and violent end at the hands of the Maoist insurgents, possibly in a raid on his police station. What a sad and lonely way and place to die, I thought. That night, I dreamt vividly of Tommy Darling and the horrors he must have faced in his dying moments. In my dream, he was blindfolded, on his knees, hands tied behind his back, as a young, skinny, trembling Malayan boy held a gun to the back of his head. Everyone was screaming and panic-stricken, but Tommy Darling was stoically calm, except for a single tear that slid out from behind his blindfold and plopped down unnoticed onto the jungle floor. Wednesday the 30th of June 2010. I awoke sweating and disoriented at 4:30 a.m. I couldn't get back to sleep. I didn't really want to. I got up, did some yoga, but that didn't help. I decided to go for a walk. The sun was just beginning to peek out over the horizon. The gardens of this hotel were lush and airy, with pools at either end, and beyond the perimeter fence, the jungle in all its primal, fertile plenty beckoned. I thought of my grandfather standing here looking out at this natural bounty, this explosion of nature. This is the air he would have breathed, I thought. It was beautiful. It was magical. I thought of what his life must have been like back in St. Albans, all frost, loneliness, twitching neck curtains and mean little hedges. No wonder he came back here, where there was this, where he was someone. I swam in the pool. It felt good to be submerged. Under the water, my jet lag had no purchase. I was the lone survivor in a post-apocalyptic paradise. As I stretched out on a chaise, contemplating what my day would reveal to me, a door to the main building behind me creaked open, and a little man carrying a huge bundle of towels appeared. I watched him as he struggled towards me, his face peeping out from behind his load from time to time, checking that he was still on the right path. He arrived at his station and dropped the towels into a basket, then picked one up and came over to me, brandishing it with both hands and a little bow. "You have jet lag," he said with a smile. "Yes," I replied. "How do you know?" "Only jet lag people swim at 5:30, he responded. I laughed. "You will have beautiful day," he said, starting to back away. "I hope so," I replied quietly and smiled. "No need to hope," he said over his shoulder. "Many happy things will happen to you today." And then he was gone, and I was alone again. I shivered and wrapped myself up in the towel and made my way back to my room. After breakfast, we travelled to Chaha, and I was taken to an old colonial-style country clubhouse, complete with elephants' hoof side tables and various stuffed animal heads mounted on the walls. Outside was a pool, glimmering in the baking sun. I wanted to jump in. I wanted to do anything other than do what I was about to do. At the other end of the room was an old English military man who I had been told had served with my grandfather in the Malayan police force. His name was Roy Sampson, and the second I saw him, I felt impending doom. Elizabeth was intentionally keeping Roy away until the crew was ready and we were set up on a terrace outside. Then I sat listening to him regale me with tales of killing young communist guerrillas during jungle patrols. The relish with which Roy remembered these details did not sit easy with me, and I interrupted him impatiently for information about my grandfather. Poor Roy.
He had the air of a man who no longer got the opportunity to spout forth very often, and now, given the chance, he was doing so with loquaciousness and even glee. When we killed somebody, they were brought back to the police station for display to the public for two reasons. First of all, they had to be identified, and secondly, we wanted the local population to see what happens to terrorists, to give them a deterrent, in fact, from joining them. Now these are a couple of pictures of those decorations to the police stations, if I may use the term, and they became the responsibility of Tom. He laid out some pictures on the raffia drinks table between us. They showed the lifeless bodies of young Asian men laid out on the ground, and just behind them, squatting in a semicircle, beaming proudly for the camera as though these young men were antelope or some other big game catch they had just taken in sport, were the British officers and their guides. Roy was amongst them. I was truly disgusted. I paused for a few moments. I wanted to get up and walk away from this man. I knew that his purpose here was to tell me something shocking about the death of my grandfather, but the way he was casually tossing down in front of me photographs of people he had killed made me worried that he would be as cavalier and insensitive about Tommy Darling's end. My stomach had started to churn. The jet lag was kicking in again. All I wanted to do was jump into that pool that sparkled behind me. I gritted my teeth and held up another picture. In the foreground was a young man's contorted body, his eyes closed, his mouth agape. Poor Tommy Darling, who had been sent to Dulali to recover from the mental damage the horrors of jungle warfare had inflicted on him, was now once more face to face with the worst that mankind could inflict, death and humiliation and hubris. Roy told me that this picture had been taken just outside of the Chaha police station. These bodies were literally dumped on my grandfather's doorstep. I sat back in my chair, stunned, my mind swirling. I looked over at Elizabeth. She nodded. We'd discussed earlier that I should procure from Roy some general background of what life was like in the village. When I thought I'd heard enough, I would ask the question I was dying to have answered. I steeled myself. I asked Roy to tell me how my grandfather had died. I hoped the look on my face made it clear to him that I needed him to go easy. Well, realise that I wasn't there when Tom did die, so I can only tell you what the story was at the time, and that was that he was playing Russian roulette. He kept talking, but my world stopped. My brow furrowed in incomprehension, and then I reeled backwards in my chair, trying to get as far away from Roy Swanson and his horrible news as I could, just as I had reeled back from my brother 6 weeks before on my roof deck in London. Russian roulette? Russian roulette? I put both my hands to my forehead as though to shield my mind from more damage in Roy's incessant barrage. Then I smiled. The smile of a man who thinks there is nothing worse that he could ever hear. I was suddenly very aware of the camera that was mere feet from my face. This was the bargain, of course. I had finally got to the bottom of the mystery of my grandfather's death, but now the world would get to see me distraught, vulnerable, real. This was truly reality TV. And Roy kept talking. I can tell you now that he certainly had absolutely no reason that we knew of to deliberately kill himself, and the conclusion that I arrive at personally was that he either got careless, or he ran out of luck, or both. My eyes began to fill with tears, but I didn't have time for that yet. I needed to stop Roy and get some things clear. Russian roulette. People played that? I managed. You feed a round into one chamber of a revolver, Roy began. Oh, I know what it is. I know, I interrupted. And you put it to your head. I'm told that somebody who is accustomed to doing it can tell by the feel of the pistol whether the round's at the top, opposite the barrel, or whether it's down at the bottom. I nodded for too long and too quickly, doing my best to remain calm. But was it a common thing to do? To play Russian roulette here? I asked. I think it was for Tom. He had a reputation. The story was that he'd been playing it regularly for quite some time. My CO knew about it. He told us about it. And Tom's own immediate senior would have known about it. And the only conclusion I can arrive at is that Tom was so highly thought of as a police officer that they turned a blind eye to it. My heart was pounding. All I could think about was Mary Darling. I have to tell this to Mary Darling. I'm sorry to have to say that to you, he continued. I was taken aback by his sudden kindness. Oh, don't worry. Don't worry, I want to know.
I replied. I lied. Just a little. And as I say, he continued, the brief sliver of tenderness he had shown gone forever, I wasn't holding his hand at the time it happened. I didn't judge Tom Darling for a second. I just tried to put it all together in a logical way. The photos, and the way Roy had talked about killing those men, those decorations, as he'd put it, I couldn't relate to that kind of chaos. If that was your reality, I think you'd have a completely different attitude about the value of life, including your own. Mostly I was just sad that my grandfather had met his end alone, never knowing the emptiness he would leave behind. His life meant so little to him then that the thought probably never occurred to him. We had a somber lunch in the